Hello and welcome back to Mess Explores with Xavier and Alan, where as always we'll be looking at all manner of films from around the world. This week, for our last episode of Season 3, we're hitting the road in Japan for Drive My Car. So let's shut the door, pop the sunroof and get started. Hello Alan.
Hello Xavier, and of course, hello to our favourite fans. Welcome back to Mess Explores. Before we grapple with Chekhov and a wife's infidelity, remember as always our podcasts are best enjoyed if you've seen the film prior, as we do contain spoilers. As Xavier said, we are looking at Drive My Car, which is a 2021 film written and directed by Rukushi Hamaguchi, and the film is inspired by a short story by Haruki Murakami of the same name. Now, Drive My Car stars Hidetoshi Nirishima, Toko Miura, and Reika Kurashima, just to name a few. So without further ado, Xavier, let's get straight into the film. What did you think?
Look, I'm actually very much a Haruki Murakami fan. Oh, I've read a number of his books, and I might even go as far as to say he's possibly one of my favourite authors. Now, I know this film was loosely based off one of his short stories, but even so, the pacing of this film felt very much like a Murakami piece. There's a slow, considered pace to it that carried great weight in the form of characters encumbered with the burden of personal crises and the great many forms those may come in, be they emotional, spiritual, physical, and so on. And I like a deep film, and this gave me exactly that, and when coupled to the somewhat anthropomorphized notion of a vehicle bearing great personal meaning, I was actually captivated. So on the whole, I thoroughly enjoyed this film. How about you?
Look, the film explores the universal language of grief and heartbreak, which is spotlighted in this film. It shows that intimate conversations can happen in confined spaces, and a car space is, I guess, mysterious in that way. You know, everyone is looking in the one direction, and I guess that relieves the angst and allows people to sort of open up and explore certain truths. The film also explores living despite loss, and I guess which is a concept that's even more relatable during the pandemic. Now, one thing the viewer notices is that there's no flashbacks in this film, and the narrative only focuses in one direction, which reminded me of the image, I guess, of the rearview mirror of a moving car, and I think that's very thematic, especially in this movie. Now, characters come alive, not in visions of who they were, but in the product of those experiences in who they are now. Now, unlike you, Sam, I'm not too familiar with Murakami's works, but Carlos Aguila actually suggests that the spontaneous friction that sort of sets in as one of the storytelling layers that eventually sort of overlaps with sort of self-referential grace under the auspicious narrative guidance of Hamaguchi and co-screenwriter Tamasaka Oe.
Look, in the Murakami works I've read, he focuses deeply on introspection and how our views on ourselves form the projection we put to the world so far as how others see us. And this film maintained that angle quite well. Yeah, the film didn't dwell on the past, but it mentioned it enough that we had relevant context. And I like what you say about moving forward. You know, for we saw characters who were all shackled by something in their past that inhibited their present, but all of them sought to break free. And as you say, you know, they were always looking for it. And this is something which we saw countless moments of throughout the film, and some were more of it than others. You know, for instance, when Kafutu said, "Don't call her my wife," it spoke to something deeper and mysterious, and it questioned our assumptions, or the fact that Li Yune was a mute seeking to forge a new path in life, or the fact that Misaki had a presumably bipolar mother, right through to concepts such as the codependency of people in times of great need. And this was again something we saw, for example, in Kafutu and Otto post losing their child.
That quote that you just mentioned, Zabe, that it, I guess that's another very great example of how layered this film is and how intricate the relationships are, and I guess the self-introspection of these characters are in this film. You know, even with Sachi's bipolar mother, we don't actually get to sort of see that or experience that until the very third act of the film. You know, initially we don't even know much about her as the driver, and as the film progresses and the conversations continue in that intimate setting, we unpack slowly about each character's background, or especially Sachi's.
Well, look, speaking about the characters, obviously this was a masterclass in acting in some front. So do you want to talk about some of the acting a little bit for us?
Yes. So look, as Yasuke, Nishijima, you know, has a certain severity to it. You know, he's sort of inscrutable and almost possesses this martial self-discipline of someone who's accustomed to leadership and to giving orders to, you know, to actors while seeming sort of open to suggestions. Now, Miura's performance as Misaki has its own reserve, and, you know, as his confessor and as a fellow smoker character in the film. Now, Peter Brashaw further explains our thoughts on Misaki and identifies her character growing in importance. And in a film's extraordinary final section, her story is told, like we just mentioned before, in a story that sort of need not thematically dovetail with everything that's got sort of gone before, you know, other than to show us once again that other people's lives are complicated and withheld, and that, you know, we're being arrogant if we think that we know everything there is to know about people that we meet.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, this film is about the human condition, how we connect to one another, be it through, you know, love, pain, loss, or acceptance.
Yeah, you're right, Sam. And I think Hamaguchi sort of first bursts into the film scene with his hits like Happy Hour and Osaka 1 and Osaka 2. And when asked why, you know, it took this long for a Japanese film to be nominated, you know, he responded that there has been many great Japanese films in the past, but I think there's a recent shift in the academy and how, I guess, Asian films are now received. So I know that he had Mass Explores. We, you know, we've debated in previous podcast episodes whether the Oscars have sort of gone from one extreme to another far left liberal pandering organization, but I guess that's a debate for another day. Look, for this film, in my opinion, there was something very special. It's refreshing and thought-provoking, and it's one of those films that's layered. And I'm not just sort of saying this as a cop-out. Even if you aren't well-versed in literature, the more you read up on this film, the more depth and meaning you uncover. And there's so much going on, and in what some may perceive as a long and slow film, but there's layers and themes explored, you know, which are dense. We have such characters grappling with complexities of Chekhov's work, you know, his wife's infidelity, the loss of his daughter. You know, there's other characters that are dealing with their own identity and profoundly leaving a career in search of sort of self-enlightenment, only to sort of allow their emotions to throw the whole career out the window. Now, the film also explores unconventional love in unconventional places, and I guess finally, dealing with death and guilt and processing all that.
Mm. No, I think you're right. And I do just want to briefly circle back to the Academy and sort of how it's changed. I don't want to go on about this much, but I think it is also worth mentioning that irrespective of sort of what level people hold something like the Academy Awards at, yeah, it is at the end of the day an American institution. There are plenty of other film awards and ceremonies industry sort of do offer up their own awards as well, you know, whether it's Cannes Film Festival right through to, you know, local things in the likes of South African cinema and whatnot. And I think, you know, many films, you know, for example, this film have done very well, and, you know, previous films in Japan have done very well too on international platforms. And I don't think holding the Oscars up as the be-all and end-all really is a healthy thing. And I think, you know, people, if they really do love cinema, they should look further afield than just what the Oscars, you know, offers up and thinks, because there are some truly brilliant things out of there that never really make it to mainstream, but it doesn't mean that they're not good.
No, and you're spot on. Like, there are so many hidden gems out there that, you know, that don't get the light that they deserve. Mm. And there's such great directors and actors out there, and, like, films that, you know, I guess hopefully our listeners can explore through our episodes.
Exactly. And this is the thing. Like, we've done many a film that has been hugely successful on international festival stages, may not have won Cannes Festival, and they may certainly have not won an Oscar, but they've won plenty of other things, and they were fantastic films.
Yeah.
Anyway, we digress. Back to the themes about, you know, Chekhov and Uncle Vanya and so forth. Do you want to talk us a little bit about Uncle Vanya?
Of course. Now, look, to give our listeners more context and to help us extrapolate deeper meaning, you know, I want to sort of briefly address the play Kafuku is actually directing, which is Uncle Vanya, which is Anton Chekhov's play. Now, it's a dark comedy about a wealthy couple who plans to sell their country estate, much to the embarrassment of their family members who work there. And I guess one of the themes that's most prevalent throughout the entire novel is disillusionment. Now, Uncle Vanya is deeply embittered, you know, over having spent his life toiling for the benefit of Srebrenikov, who's a once-worshipped scholar that Vanya has discovered to be nothing more than a charlatan. Now, I believe that the words that Kafuku was unable to express and say as a character was told through Chekhov's Uncle Vanya play. You know, like, rather than using a first person to articulate this, I guess the director uses images and the play within the film to convey Kafuku's self-expression. Now, Chekhov's play, with all its desperation and regret for missed life chances, has become a touchstone for Yasuke and is almost a separate character in the movie. Now, what if someone else was playing Vanya and not him? What if someone else was with his wife and not him? And what if he had been able to master his feelings, swallow his pride, and actively confront his wife with what he knew about her secret, about her erotic life, and how much he's actually been hurt by this? You know, would this blaze of attempted honesty have saved their relationship, or would it have further destroyed it? And I guess that's the beauty of this film. It has all these questions that, you know, are unanswered, but we still have to move forward as a viewer.
I think at the end of the day, what you're getting at here is almost an element of looking back at one's life with regret and perhaps at times resentment. But I feel that what was important here wasn't necessarily regret, but acceptance. Being grateful for what we had and might still have, respecting what we have lost by moving forward without resent, and honoring our past, but seeking to create a better future. Of course, all of this comes at great personal cost for some, and all of us struggle with our own obstacles and demons. But the most important lesson, to my viewing, it was having the courage to accept your path, face your fears, and continue to forge a better one as we move forward.
Now, speaking of Uncle Vanya Save, the actual play itself is delivered in a multilingual aspect of the play. Now, in my opinion, with the multilingual aspect of the film, the actors, or I should say the characters in the film, aren't really understanding the meaning of each other's words. So instead, the body language and the actual voice and how it's projected, how it's enunciated, is what becomes more important in conveying the meaning of the script itself. And especially when you're doing such complex play like Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. So the state of response, it becomes easy for the characters to focus and to react. And I guess that's the purpose of this specific method that, you know, he implements.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with that assessment, to be honest. I think they all understand the words, but to each person, meaning is different because the struggles we all face are different. Whether it's the loss of love, loss of speech, the loss of life, it all affects us differently. And therefore, even though we may all read the same words, how it comes out for all of us can be remarkably and sometimes dramatically different. That's what I got out of it.
Right. The reason why I interpreted the way I did was because when they have the dinner at Lee Yuna's house, you know, she sort of says to him, I think she's the only one who's understood the process as to why he does it in a specific way, as to why he makes them read the script and just focus on the words itself. Because later on in the acting process, they discover, you know, this certain magic that happens between two different native speaking characters. They still sort of yield this performance that transcends the script itself. And I think that was the beauty of, you know, his directing.
No, fair enough. But look, one other language I would actually like to touch on here, though, is actually the language of objects.
Yeah.
And it's the deeper interpretation we derive from that which we surround ourselves with, whether that be what we adorn our homes with, which is what we probably see most commonly, or the adoration we show towards a particular object. And in this case, of course, I'm talking about Kafuku's red Saab 900 Turbo.
Yeah.
Now, while the Saab was a character in its own right, as mute as Lee Yuna, what we got from the car wasn't really about the car itself. What we got was an insight into the soul of Kafuku. And that was, you know, what he appreciated, what he respected, what he valued, and the level of care he showed towards the things he loved. And this car was a perpetuated symbol of his love for Otto, and by extension, I guess, a piece of a soul he was trying to cling to. Yeah, it was a beautiful element of unspoken anthropomorphism and something which actually resonated quite deeply with me. As a side note though, as a bit of a car fiend myself, I was intrigued to note that this car is actually left-hand drive whilst Japan is a right-hand drive country. I don't know if there was this particular reason for that or not, but so be it. But while the car was a character in itself, despite it being remarked how exceptionally well cared for it was, I actually found it a little bit annoying that the car, which was apparently so well cared for, actually kept appeared to having bulb failures during production, as it wasn't the same bulbs that were out throughout the movie. Now, I don't actually mind, but it was just something that I noticed, and it annoys me that I notice these things sometimes, but it was just curious.
Oh, look, I think you're one of the most eagle-eyed viewers that there can be. Even especially to notice which side of the car that the driver sits on, that completely went past my viewing experience.
Oh, so you didn't notice which parking light kept failing in the car?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
I even looked at the dash to see what warning light was on at one point.
Now, look, I think the car is certainly an extension of the character. For an instant, the characters and the car fuse, and it's almost like his wife's words captured to the tape that he plays continuously functions as fuel for both Kafuku and the vehicle itself. And I guess in a sense it does, because since the audio accompanies the driver like an auditory soul kilometer after kilometer. In an interview, Aguilera actually further suggests that the artist's car is a temple of freedom and solitude, the embodiment of return and departure, the way back home, you know, to his beloved, and the escape from the fallout of their present. It's in the silence of that moving space that Otto's voice comes through the speakers via, you know, the aforementioned tape, feeding him the lines, a lifeline, and what she actually recites might come from the classic text or maybe even directly from her, but the distinction doesn't matter, because both become one in the same inner continuum. But speaking of, you know, the car and the two characters in it, let's talk about the relationship between Yasuke and Misaki.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess little by little, Yasuke begins to talk to Misaki and gets her to tell him her story. Their daily drives become a two-way, I guess, confessional, and a bond is sort of formed between, you know, this unlikely pair, you know, like who come from different generations, from different parts of Japan. And there's this element of, I guess, father and daughter. I don't know if that was sort of intended or shoehorned in because his daughter was also four. Maybe that was just like that whole aspect was used to amplify his anguish. But like most of the human connections in this movie, it's the relationship of an emotional depth, and there's a sense of psychological complexity to the characters.
Look, I actually like the way that you've likened the car to a confessional as well, because I think it goes beyond just the characters of Yasuke and Misaki as well. Because the young actor as well, and I forget his name at the moment, but the one that also had an affair with Kifuku's wife, he also gets into the backseat of the car at one point, and Kifuku and he actually have quite an extensive conversation about his wife and, you know, what she was like and her final dream and so on and so forth. And the car seemed to provide this very safe space. And I think when we saw that some of these conversations took place outside of the car, such as in the bar or whatnot, it tended to result in distractions and acts of violence, which ultimately was a young man's downfall. But in the car, it was a safe space. Nothing was held against anyone. There was no distractions. And Kifuku even makes a point of saying, you know, don't worry about Misaki, like, she can be trusted, she doesn't hear anything. And it's almost like she's that sort of priest in the room that just overhears the confessional but doesn't actually do anything with it. The car is a sacred space and whatever happens in there stays in there. So I really liked the fact that that relationship dynamic went beyond just Yasuke and Misaki, because there was more to it, and the car was representative of so much more in their relationship and the relationships of those others that happened to be in the car. Likewise, Otto, you know, she'd obviously been in this car. Yasuke didn't obviously like her driving it particularly often, but, you know, he also held on to the fact that it was something that reminded him of her as well.
Mm.
So it was a massively complicated relationship dynamic, a lot of which took place inside the car.
Now, the car actually plays a pivotal role at the final scene because we see the owners have changed. Do you want to talk a little bit about that before we wrap it up?
Yeah, okay. So, you know, obviously at the end, the car ends up with Misaki. We see it, you know, she walks back to the car park. She now has a dog and whatnot. And there was a couple other things that occurred in this scene too, such as when she's driving away, we notice that her scar is gone. And you go, well, is this intentional? You know, has she moved on with her life? Did Kifuru end up dying or simply moving on? How much time has subsequently passed? To my reading, I would assume a few years based on the film, but further reading actually suggests it's probably only a couple of months and that Kifuru had moved. That's sort of neither here nor there at the end. I think the important thing here, as you say, is the car. It's not necessarily the characters themselves, but it's the fact that the car now belongs to someone else. And that as a vessel, you know, almost religious in nature, you know, that confessional type structure, this car has seen out the lives of a relationship and it's now moved to someone else. And it will be that for someone else, like this sort of noble steed that is passed on from one generation to the next. And again, it's a very anthropomorphic way to look at an object, but I think, you know, a lot of people even name their cars. It's just not uncommon. Cars do take on this sort of anthropomorphic nature. And for that to happen in the film, I think was a really pivotal thing, because it wasn't the fact that we saw that Misaki had moved on with her life. The most crucial thing was the fact that the car had moved on into her life in its own right. And that was just very interesting.
Yeah, look, I think the ending sort of seems like they're in Korea, but I almost felt like without the final scene, the film would have been somewhat perfect. But when you add a scene like this, the element or the nuance of imperfections created, had the film finished with the scene prior with the applause of the play, it would have felt like the narrative has come full circle. But I felt like this ending was a bit disruptive, and I think it was actually intentional as well. Does the title of the film have a clue as to how we interpret the ending? But if I was to hazard a guess, safe, I want to say that I think her scar has been removed, and symbolically her burden that she's carried like all her life has also been removed.
I personally like the final scene, as it left the door open on a life yet to live, rather than a cliche conclusion. But I do agree with your assessment of the scar. I suspect it was a visual representation of the guilt she's made her peace with. So I completely agree with you there. But just something else I'd like to touch on there is your question about, you know, does the title of the film have a clue in how we can interpret the ending? Drive My Car. I think it does, because I think it, at a certain extent, it's almost like that offering of, I've given away something that's most important to me. That is my car. That is my memories. That is the life I lived for umpteen years with this car. I now entrust it to you for you to make a new life with it and for it to take you away from whatever your demons are and to somewhere new for you. And I think that was a very poetic notion, and I liked it myself. I mean, if you want a little bit of personal insight into my life, listeners, when my best friend passed away, I went and sat in my Land Rover. I've got an old red, funnily enough, Land Rover, and that was my escape. And not long after that, I ended up driving that Land Rover halfway around the world. That was my thing, and I subsequently brought it back home to Australia. So I think, you know, that idea of entrusting someone else to that vehicle is a very, very personal and emotional thing for someone that has put that level of love into an object, that because they are bonded to it. It is more than just a motor vehicle. It is representative of something about them. It has a piece of their soul. For the Potterheads out there, it's almost like a Horcrux in a sort of a nice way. And, you know, if you want to be totally blunt about it, I dumped a girl that stood on the seats of my car because she completely disrespected it. I know that might sound ridiculous to people, but I think if you understand the nature of where characters like Kafuku come from with that relationship with an object and how it means so much more to them than what you may see on the outside as extrinsic value, then you realize there's actually something much more intrinsic to it. Anyway, that's getting very deep and meaningful. Should we move on to cinematography? I know you wanted to talk about red cars.
We shall, but I think you've just reminded me about something else. In our Nomadland episode, when we see the protagonists sort of give away all their personal belongings that have meant to them, or even when those break, it's almost like them leaving everyone else with that, you know, like with their memories, and they're about to start a new life. So that's like, you know, when you were just talking there, it just reminded me of that specific scene from Nomadland.
No, I understand.
Now, with cinematography, say, changing the color of the car, because these look... We all know that this is an adaptation of a short story, and the color of the car was changed from yellow, which was the original color in the short story, to red in order for Hamaguchi to sort of incorporate the Japanese scenery on the screen, because I guess yellow tends to blend in with the greens a little bit more, which is why that decision was sort of made to use the red and allow the car to stand out a little bit more.
Yeah, look, I think it worked well as red. And to be honest, while I love bold, rich yellow vehicles, I struggle to actually picture it in this scenescape. You know, I also like the fact that we had lots of shots that tracked the cars that drove from a distance against that thicket of dense greenery, because it really slowed down the pace of the film to be a measured beat, but the car still stood out like a very striking, I guess, materialistic object in an otherwise natural setting. And I think, you know, that was reminiscent of things in itself. But I also like the fact that we frequently saw the film from within the confines of the vehicle, and the shots frequently varied. You know, whether it was the mirror shot, a dirty three shot from the front, side profile from the rear, external looking in, internal looking out. It was a discreet yet rich range of shot choices in this film, which I suspect many failed to notice, but it was actually done to great effect and further heightened the relationship that these people had within the confines of this vehicle.
Yeah. Now that I'm reflecting back on it, you're right. Like, there was a multitude of shots in that car, and as a viewer, you do feel more connected with the characters and the car itself.
And one shot that really sort of stood out to me when I was watching the film was after Misaki and Yusuke have actually walked away from the car, and I think they've walked up to where her old house was that had been ruined in the small landslide, there was a shot where we just sat on this red Saab sitting in the snow. It was a hero shot. Nothing was said. There was no sound. There was no comment. It didn't really lead to anywhere else. It was almost just like the car is the hero. It has brought these people to this point in their life. This is where there's going to be a change. And I think it was just a beautiful shot of, one, just a red Saab, but two, it just had so much meaning if you understood what it was going for.
Yeah, that's right. So, Save, with that being said, shall we wrap this film up?
Absolutely. Give us your closing remarks.
Look, I think Hamaguchi's Drive My Car is perhaps best compared to a montage or a composition of short narratives, maybe even an archipelago of character lives. Yasuke, Otto, and Misaki are living their own lives, and the drama superimposes and overlaps like a Venn diagram. As a viewer, there's something very moving, you know, when we hone into like one of these characters' narratives and lives. We have such characters in the film that are grappling with the complexities of Juno Chekhov's work, a wife's infidelity, and the loss of their daughter. Other characters are dealing with their own identity and profoundly in search of self-enlightenment, only to allow their emotions to throw their career out the windows. Now, this film explores unconventional love in unconventional places, and obviously, finally, it deals with death and guilt and acceptance. So overall, the film was an enthralling and applauding experience for me, and it's for this reason I'm going to give it a 7.5 out of 10.
Look, I generally have nothing more to add to that. I think you've summarized that beautifully, with the minor caveat that I'm actually going to give this film a slightly higher score at 7.9 out of 10.
Yeah, I was considering, but I didn't know.
That's all right. You got to be fair. But look, that's all from us, folks. And remember, you can let us all know what films you'd like us to do too. Just drop us a comment on our socials. But until then, we hope you've enjoyed another season from us. We will be returning for season 4 with many wonderful new films from around the world. So remember to give us a follow on your favorite listening platform and subscribe to Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and recommend us to your friends and family. Until next season, though, goodbye from us.
Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. And if you haven't listened to any of our episodes, go back and listen to them. We have a really great catalog for the last 3 seasons. But until then, we'll see you soon.